From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Hong Kong's chief executive declares an end to more than 11 weeks of sit-in pro-democracy protests. Skepticism about a 60-nation coalition's plans to defeat ISIL.
This is not a powerful coalition in terms of deployed forces. Its potential is not the reality that is shaping the strikes against the Islamic State.
Voices on both sides of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict question the U.S. role as a shepherd of peace negotiations. I'm Susan Yawkey. Hong Kong Chief Executive Leung Chung Lee today declared an end to more than 11 weeks of sit-in pro-democracy protests as police cleared the last of three main protest sites in the Chinese territory. CY Leung said, with the completion of clearance work in the Causeway Bay Occupy area, the episode of what he called illegal occupation activities is over. He said the demonstrations caused serious losses in tourism and harmed retail sectors of the city. Protesters have been demanding free leadership elections and Mr. Leung's resignation. China says candidates for high office must be approved by a pro-Beijing nominating process. Michael DeGuyler, a professor at Hong Kong Baptist University, told VOA's Victor Beatty, while this phase of the so-called Occupy Central protest movement is over, other tactics will be attempted.
Various groups have taken to using a variety of other techniques to try to pressure the government and also to express their sentiments. For example, in the first site that was cleared in Mong Kok, you have large groups of people assembling, basically getting the attention of the police and then moving en masse as a group. Ostensibly, they say they're window shopping, but what they're doing as they move along in a large enough group to block the streets, but they don't block the streets. They will occasionally linger in crosswalks and so forth, and the police basically follow along rather nervously, trying to keep them from stepping into the streets and reestablishing a blockade. So it ties up police manpower, and they're followed around. You know, there's a variety of techniques now, and some people have even talked about trying to persuade taxpayers, for example, not to pay their taxes or to delay paying the taxes or to send in their taxes, for example, a series of checks, each of them totaling $6.89 or $689. This is in reference to the 689 votes out of 1,200 votes that the current chief executive got from the election committee.
What has the two-month Occupy Central effort accomplished?
Certainly, at the beginning, it was an expression of the majority of people in Hong Kong who wanted a much more democratic form of electing the chief executive than the one that is currently possible given the restrictions that were handed down at the end of August by the Standing Committee of the National People's Congress. This is the immediate cause of the Occupy Central protesting that ruling that basically ruled out public nomination, and even many people argue the possibility of a fair nominating process. The tactic, though, of blocking streets, while it was at the very beginning strongly supported, not quite a majority, but close to that, after the police used tear gas, that number began to diminish quite strongly until it was less than a third of people were supporting blocking streets. So in this case, one of the results of Occupy Central is to cost the Democrats some public esteem. There's been a drop in all of the numbers indicating support for all of the politicians in general, but the Democrats have taken a bigger hit. The second thing it's done is the pro-government group, which is largely opportunist. They were always characterized as, parroting the Beijing line or pro-Beijing line, but they did it rather lifelessly. There wasn't a lot of passion on their side. What we've seen in the last 2 months of Occupy Central is an increasing amount of anger and passion on the part of the pro-government people and people who want their lives to get back to normal. And what we've also seen is that even among professionals now, we've seen a real split in their ranks, an increased polarization that is increasingly vocal and bitter and strongly held and strongly expressed. So polarization has certainly increased, but it's gone from passion being mostly on the side of the Democrats to now where we have passionate groups on both sides of the aisle.
DeGorler says while it appears the central Chinese government has won this round, all the pan-Democrats in Hong Kong have to do is remain united among their members in the 70-member Legislative Council to block any reforms they don't like. He says they currently have 27 votes and only need 23 to veto such reforms. But he says the big winner in that case could be CY Leung, who would easily win nomination for a second term as chief executive. China says it is shocked by violent protests last week at a Chinese-owned sugar plant in Madagascar. The Chinese embassy blames Madagascar officials for not doing their duty to protect Chinese interests. Last week, at least four people died in clashes between police and workers at the plant in the town of Morondava. Workers at the plant are demanding better contracts for seasonal workers. The Chinese embassy has called the demands unreasonable. A 60-nation coalition meeting in Brussels recently agreed to a wide range of steps to weaken the Islamic militant group ISIL in Syria and Iraq. But there is skepticism in some quarters about whether the group has the will to commit the resources needed to do the job. Analyst Anthony Quartersman of the Center for International Studies tells VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawi the coalition's tough words will not be taken seriously unless they are willing to put boots on the ground.
You can't deal with ISIS or the Islamic State unless you have Iraqi unity. The U.S. has made some progress in bringing the Kurds and the Iraqi Shiites together. As yet, it has not shown that it can bring the Iraqi Sunnis together, and that's absolutely critical to any kind of effort to free Western Iraq and key cities like Mosul from the Islamic State. The second issue is that it is not yet clear exactly what the U.S. strategy is in dealing with the Islamic State in Syria. So far, the airstrikes from both the U.S. and coalition have been very limited. They have not moved to the level where they can defeat the Islamic State, and that's a critical security issue. The other much broader problem is that the U.S. has talked about training very limited numbers of Syrian rebels that presumably would be moderate and that the U.S. would arm. But over the last few weeks, the rebels that had armed in the past have suffered from very serious military defeat. And it's not clear at all that the United States has a strategy for dealing with Syria, with Assad, or even finding a set of compromises with Turkey that would allow the U.S. to use Incirlik without becoming deeply involved in the creation of a buffer zone and U.S. military involvement against the Assad forces.
60 partners in the global coalition to counter ISIL agreed in their meeting in Brussels to support military operations, stopping the flow of foreign terrorists, and cutting ISIL's funding. How significant is that to improve the strategy to defeat the so-called Islamic State?
The NATO meeting essentially simply agreed to what had already been agreed. This is not something new. The U.S. began its airstrikes in August. It began to build up its coalition. There are now some 60 countries involved. NATO has long been involved in counterterrorism efforts to limit the movement of volunteers in both directions. But these are essentially political announcements because the key issues are being solved on a state-to-state basis, and the coordination of operations is taking place in the field and in the Gulf area at places like the U.S. Air Base at El Udeid and the Fifth Fleet. It's not something which NATO basically is going to deal with collectively.
Participants also commended the actions of the moderate Syrian opposition forces fighting against ISIL and called for increased support to these forces. Do you think the coalition have provided the moderate Syrian opposition with what is needed in its fight on multiple fronts against ISIL and the Syrian regime?
Well, I think it's very clear it hasn't, but the problem is when you talk about the moderate opposition, the vast majority of the opposition is Islamists. The two most important groups are the Islamic State and the al-Nusra Front, which is tied to al-Qaeda. The basic problem is to create a meaningful moderate rebel group, and it's not clear that anyone as yet can do that. The other thing that's very important to understand is that the key players in this are the United States, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Qatar, and Kuwait, and to a much smaller degree, France. So the key issues in it so far, backing the moderate rebels, have almost nothing to do with NATO. Now, if France and Turkey became actively involved, that would be a different story. But that won't be a NATO decision. It will be a decision by France and by Turkey.
How about the Free Syrian Army? Is it capable of being the core force of the moderate Syrian opposition?
Well, the Free Syrian Army is simply a name. It has a number of elements, and the elements the U.S. did most to arm and equip were decisively defeated in northern Syria over the last 3 weeks and lost much of their equipment. It's nice to have the name. It would be much nicer if that name had capability.
Why would defeating ISIL take several years when it is encountered by such powerful coalition of more than 60 nations?
Well, these are very powerful nations, but the U.S. has limited its air presence. It's only flying about 15 to 20 strikes a day. That's a very limited number. It is not willing to deploy ground forces. It is not willing to become involved in the Syrian civil war. And so far, Turkey has refused to become involved, as distinguished from asking the U.S. to create a buffer state. Iraq itself is in the middle of a civil war. Now, some of that may have been reduced by a recent agreement between the central government and the Kurds, but the Iraqi army virtually disintegrated. The U.S. is essentially trying now to spend at least a year to train and equip 9 brigades out of what used to be a 46-brigade force, and U.S. efforts to create a Sunni National Guard as yet have not produced any significant progress. They may in the future, but the U.S. is, again, it's willing to put in limited amounts of air power. It's willing to play a train and assist role. There are other countries concentrating on trying to reduce the flow of money and volunteers. There are other countries flying sorties, but this is not a powerful coalition in terms of deployed forces. Its potential is not the reality that is shaping the strikes against the Islamic State.
Analyst Anthony Quartersman of the Center for International Studies in Washington. Voices on both sides of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict question the U.S. role as shepherd of peace negotiations. Even Americans seem increasingly skeptical about their government's engagements in the Middle East. Friday, we heard from Shibli Telhami of the Brookings Institution on his survey on American public attitudes toward the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Today, VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawy asks, beyond the question of who is more at fault in the conflict, what sort of future for the Israelis and the Palestinians do Americans feel the U.S. should support?
What's interesting about this poll, beyond, you know, identifying very clearly the differences between Democrats and Republicans, and really independents are closer to Democrats on this issue than they are to Republicans, that's big because that, of course, has consequences for the way politicians line up their positions for primaries, which are party-based. But if you look beyond that, you find that there is kind of a general American mood that is focused on equality and human rights as something that they think America stands for. And you find the deviation of them from that gets criticism. And so, therefore, when you ask them what would happen if there is if two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict were no longer possible, do they favor Israel being more of a Jewish state at the expense of not having full equality for Palestinians, or Israel should be a democracy at the expense of no longer being a Jewish state? And what you find is the overwhelming majority, over 70%, say that they prefer democracy over Jewishness. And I think that's a certain level of discomfort with the idea that is being put forth here. And I think you find, as a consequence of that, also a creeping moral position. And I say moral because I don't think the public thought about it very carefully in terms of practicality, but there is a creeping moral position that is increasing the support for a one-state solution which Arabs and Jews live equally, regardless of how practical that is, in part because the public sees this as a moral position if the two states were no longer possible. So, yes, it's very complicated, but I think it's very clear that Americans, in terms of how they define themselves, with the exception of some groups, highlight the notion of equality, egalitarianism, and democracy far more than other issues.
64 of the poll's participants expressed their desire for Washington to take a centrist position. What do you make of that?
That actually is not new. That we have seen historically in other polls, really dating all the way back to 20 years ago. So in some way, that is not a particularly new trend. It used to be said, though, that is only those people who want neutrality are people who don't care a lot about the issue. And I think what we find in our poll is actually that's not right. With the exception of the religious right and really the Republicans in general, if you look at the independents and Democrats who say that the issue is, the Arab-Israeli issue is important to them, it's either the top issue or in the top three, you find that they actually also want the U.S. to lean toward neither side rather than take one side. But we also find that some of those people who want the U.S. not to lean to one side are not doing it just to get out of making a decision, but they're doing it in principle and they're doing it passionately. And that includes especially people who care a lot about human rights. And we find that you know, the remarkable thing is that the human rights emerges as a central issue for such a large segment of the American public, and that more importantly, when you ask them about the Israel-Palestine question and ask them whether they see this issue as an issue of American interest, as an issue of Israeli interest, as an issue of Palestinian interest, as an issue of human rights, the largest segment of the public sees human rights as the prism through which they evaluate the Arab-Israel issue. So it's very important in connecting this issue, human rights, to American positions on the Arab-Israel issue.
There is a perception that average Americans know very little about the Middle East. How confident you are about the reliability of the survey results?
You know, at some level, of course, that's true about every issue you ever ask about. That is, the level of detail that people may have may be small. But you'd be surprised how much people pick up. And this issue has been in the news for so long that people have developed a framework to refer to it. It's been really part of it. Somebody said at one point that the Israel-Palestine question isn't just a foreign policy question, it's a domestic American political issue, and that's absolutely right.
Shibley Telemi with the Brookings Institution. A 22-year-old South African woman has won the 64th annual Miss World 2014 beauty pageant. Rolene Strauss, a medical student, was crowned this year's winner at the pageant Sunday in London. Hundreds of millions of people around the world are estimated to have seen the ceremonies on television. Hungary's Edina Gulskar came in second, and Elizabeth Savrit of the United States was third. More than 120 countries were represented. This year's pageant was marred by tragedy after the Honduran contestant, Maria Jose Alvarado, was found shot dead along with her sister last month. Police suspect the sister's boyfriend of shooting the pair after seeing his partner dancing with another man at a party. The new Miss World plans to travel to Honduras to help build a school named in honor of the murdered sisters. Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.
This is Today in History. On December 15, 37 AD, the Roman Emperor Nero was born. Nero's reign was marked initially by moderate administration and peace, but eventually devolved into one of personal excess and external revolt. A military coup resulted in his suicide in 68 AD. On this day in 1791, the first 10 amendments to the U.S. Constitution became the law of the land with their ratification by the Commonwealth of Virginia. Commonly known as the Bill of Rights, the amendments protect the basic civil liberties of Americans, guaranteeing freedom of speech, press, assembly, and the exercise of religion. In 1832, French engineer Gustave Eiffel was born. He built hundreds of metal structures around the world. His most famous, of course, was the Eiffel Tower in Paris. In 1892, American oil tycoon and financier J. Paul Getty was born. He became president and principal owner of the Getty Oil Company and one of the world's richest men. In 1939, the movie Gone with the Wind premiered in Atlanta, Georgia. The movie, set during the American Civil War in the rebellious South, remains one of the highest-grossing films in box office history. In 1961, former Gestapo officer Adolf Eichmann was sentenced to die by an Israeli court. Eichmann had played a major part in the slaughter of Jews during World War II. In 1966, animation pioneer Walt Disney died of cancer at the age of 65. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The terror group ISIL, or Daesh, as it is called in the region, is an organization with one goal, said U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, to impose its reign of terror over as many people and as much territory as it can, and by any means necessary. A broad coalition of over 60 countries has organized to fight the immediate threat posed by ISIL. But, Mr. Kerry said, a long-term strategy aimed at addressing the issues driving the cycle of conflict throughout the Middle East, including radical religious extremism, lack of economic opportunity, gross violations of human rights, and the failure to provide hope to a generation of young people, is required to secure a future where terrorists like ISIL, or Daesh in Arabic, cannot thrive. If there's any opportunity hidden in the Daesh challenge, it's the chance to build the common ground needed to address shared threats and to pursue shared interests, said Secretary Kerry. That chance, he noted, has already been seized by Iraqi and Kurdish forces, whose historic level of cooperation in their fight against ISIL has resonated deeply in both communities.
And the presence of Saudis and Emiratis and Jordanians and Qataris and others, all of them together facing this challenge now, is the sign of a new set of possibilities for regional engagement in security and counterterrorism and anti-extremism that may open new windows for all of us, including Israel, Palestinians, Jordan, Egypt.
There is still a long way to go, and the Middle East remains profoundly divided, Mr. Kerry said.
But in the midst of acts of terror and even more, we are seeing the potential of the emergence of a new regional alignment with little in common but a shared aversion to extremists. But I'll tell you what they're all telling me. They're telling me that they're prepared to stand up and make peace with Israel. And they're telling me that they believe there is in this moment the ability to create a new regional alliance against the Hamases and the Daeshes and the Arar al-Shams and the Boko Harams and so forth.
It has become clearer to all, said Secretary of State Kerry, that defeating violent extremism and strengthening regional cooperation are two ways to build a better future for the Middle East.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.